Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. We want to thank our friends at Boehringer Ingelheim for supporting this great conversation as we talk about the journey of a dog and his family dealing with mitral valve disease. And we got the one and only Dr. Whit Church in the house to talk to us more about this. How's it going, Dr. Church?
Yeah, it's good. I'm excited to do it. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Love learning from you, and especially cardiology. I feel like we can never learn enough of it. Little information about our wonderful friend, Dr. Church here, earned his DVM degree from Oregon State University in 2002. After graduation, completed a one-year small animal rotating internship at Cornell University. Then he completed his cardiology residency at both the University of Illinois and the University of Pennsylvania, moved from Philadelphia to Arizona, and started desert veterinary medical specialist in the Phoenix Valley. He's also served as an adjunct faculty at Midwestern University's College of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Church is board certified with the American College of Internal Medicine subspecialty cardiology. His special areas of interest include infectious and neoplastic pericardial diseases and interventional cardiovascular procedures. I got to ask you before we get going, what got you involved in cardiology? Why cardio?
You know, I originally wanted to do zoo medicine. And I was really interested in exotics, and I did some, my senior year, I did some rotations at the zoo, and I realized that if anything they did that I thought was really cool, we would bring in a specialist. And I thought, man, these specialists are kind of a big deal, you know? And so I kind of pivoted and did a cardiology rotation. I'd done well in cardiac phys. It always interested me. And anyway, I just decided that I wanted to be expert in something. And I, you know, not there, there are a lot of cardiologists, but you know, that's one area I think of vet school that is hard to teach. And even myself, I was not good at cardiology coming out of vet school. So it was just an area I thought I could really help and have my little niche. And so that's kind of how I ended up doing cardiology. I ended up having some great mentors at Cornell that helped me get my residency. There were, you know, at the time, there were seven places you could go for cardiology. And so I was able to get a great spot. I had great mentoring and have been able to mentor residents myself.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's a fantastic niche to be in. And thank you for all the great work you do. We need you. All right. So let's walk through the journey. Let's kind of paint the stage for our listeners here. We're going to walk you through a patient's story from the very beginning, from conception and early development of the disease, and explain how mitral valve disease begins. So take it away.
Yeah. So I thought we could talk about what a patient named Vinny that developed degenerative valve disease, and you know, got to follow this patient for years over time. And the thing about valve disease is we believe it's heritable, but we don't actually know of a specific gene. It seems to be within a range of chromosomes, but it's probably multifactorial, and there's probably several genes involved. But it also seems to have an age trigger, and maybe even environmental, if you throw in high blood pressure and some things on top of that, as far as why it progresses to severe disease in some, and others don't seem to get it very badly. But in this patient, it was named Vinny. Started out as a seven-year-old male-neutered Chihuahua that came in because of a heart murmur and wasn't having any symptoms, but had a left-sided murmur that the veterinarian found and decided to refer for a cardiac workup. And so I see Vinny, I listened to the heart murmur. It was 2 out of 6. And we did decide to do an echocardiogram. That was the only test we really did other than EKG, which we do at the time. We evaluate the blood pressure with echo by measuring the velocity of the leak in the mitral valve. which was normal. There was no heart enlargement. So we basically said, hey, look, you have this leak in your valve. We can tell the valve is degenerative. We'll see you in 12 months and see if there's any progression. And that's a really common scenario for veterinary patients, especially small breed dogs. Small breed dogs are the main breeds that get this disease. The Cavalier, King Charles Spaniel, Chihuahuas, Dachshunds are really predisposed to it. Maltese, I usually say any little white dog. And that is kind of who we're really looking for with this disease.
And so when we have Vinny coming in, what are some of the earliest warning signs that something wasn't quite right with his heart? And how do we differentiate normal variation from, say, true early mitral valve disease?
Yeah, so usually if a patient has a heart murmur, it's often due to a leak in the mitral valve if they're adults. If they're really young patients, we're thinking, oh, maybe you have a birth defect, something else. But in small breed dogs that are middle-aged to older, we just say, okay, that's going to be a leak in the mitral valve. For a physiologic flow murmur, for instance, they're usually younger dogs. They tend to be larger breeds that can get these kind of benign physiologic flow murmurs like greyhounds or whippets or boxers, Rhodesian Ridgebacks. And they have this athletic heart. It ejects a lot of blood per beat that goes out the aorta with a little bit higher velocity. And when it reaches a certain velocity, it'll start to churn and you can hear the murmur. But for these dogs, they actually have something wrong. And the earliest signs are actually exercise intolerance. But most people don't recognize that because they're just getting older and they figure, okay, they can't go as far on their walk. But most of the time when we talk about exercise intolerance and them noticing it, it's after we've diagnosed the disease. We diagnose the disease and then they look back and like, yeah, he was a little bit exercise intolerant. Or they'll say, I would have never known that there was a problem without my veterinarian listening to the heart. And that's sometimes because we don't push them to their limit, right? Dogs can go, they're pretty athletic. And so they can go really far and hard, even if they have, mild to moderate heart disease. So you really have to rely on your veterinarian to tell you often that there's a problem.
I appreciate that. Just another reason why we should be more proactive with our patients coming in for wellness checkups and auscultation, the whole nine yards. I love that. And when we're looking at, say, asymptomatic monitoring phases, how does nutrition and even supplements and lifestyle choices, how does that play a role in slowing disease progression? And what actually has some evidence behind it versus what's just hopeful thinking?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I used to throw on a supplement list after I diagnosed a patient like Vinny with mild valve disease and this, what we call myxominous mitral valve disease or degenerative valve disease. So part of it is because that's what people wanted. They wanted supplements. They wanted to do something. They wanted to be proactive. And initially I was kind of like, well, we know that taurine and L-carnitine can help improve the contraction. We know that fish oil can help reduce arrhythmias and help with kidney function. We know that L-arginine can help dilate pulmonary arteries. So I would just give them the doses for those supplements, but I didn't really have a lot of, emphasis on it. And then we started to have patients that were eating grain-free diets, and that became a really common practice for families to put their dogs on grain-free diets. Not necessarily because they had a medical reason, but just because that was available and it sounded good. And then we've realized that some dogs seem to have diet-related contractility problems with their heart if they eat high legumes. That's the reason, but there's probably some other reasons. Taurine deficiency, for instance, can do it. And the way I feel about it is if you have a bad valve, you have to have a good contraction. If the pump isn't working and the valve's not working, that is a really bad combination. And so keeping the pump strong, the way I look at it is that it helps the heart to tolerate a bad valve better. And even though we don't know of any of those supplements that help reduce valve degeneration, we feel like keeping the pump strong makes a difference. So I actually am pretty in favor of starting supplements at that stage. We call that stage B1, where they don't have a lot of heart enlargement, but they have disease. I like them to be on supplements, and I usually discourage them from eating grain-free diets that have a lot of legumes.
Oh, interesting. And then let's talk about pharmaceuticals. So when it comes time to start pharmaceuticals, how do you decide which medications to introduce and when, and what markers told you it was time to initiate those kinds of therapies?
Okay, well, this is actually the most exciting part of valve disease, I think, is and has really changed over the last 10 years, where I used to treat a lot of congestive heart failure. I used to treat stage C all the time, and that was most of my patients were in stage C, which is the congestive heart failure phase, because we weren't very good in stage B. We didn't have a lot to do in B1. And we had a little bit of influence, possibly. There was kind of borderline evidence for it in B2 for something like enalapril or benazepril to delay congestive heart failure. But when we came out with the EPIC study, the study where we evaluated giving vetmedin in stage B2, pre-heart failure or pre-symptomatic disease, we made a big difference. We showed that you could delay congestive heart failure by over 15 months compared to placebo dogs. And so all of a sudden it was like, we do not want to miss any B2 patients. So if we can get them on treatment in stage B2, then we know they're going to do better and dramatically better. I think the average patient, when they hit these certain echo criteria, there's like a left atrium aortic ratio and a ventricular diameter that we have to hit. If we hit those certain enlargement criteria and we start vetmedin, the average patient is on that treatment for 41 months before having symptoms.
Wow.
So it's pretty awesome. And it's a sad thing to tell people that their dog has enough heart disease to warrant treatment with pharmaceuticals, but I can very kind of energetically and positively say, but we're going to make a big difference in your dog's life by giving this medication.
Yeah, and quality of life is what I would add, right? It's good quality of life.
Yeah, I mean we're prolonging B2. That is a
Yeah.
fantastic stage as far as what their activity levels are. And how, they're no one in their neighborhood would know their dog has heart disease.
Right. Well, let's go back to Vinny a little bit. So I understand that he has journeyed on into congestive heart failure. So as he entered symptomatic congestive heart failure, what were some of the key clinical changes that forced you to rethink his treatment plan, and how did that medication strategy evolve?
Yeah. Well, so with Vinny, what we did is we started vetmedin once Vinny came back in. It was actually a couple years later when we finally had to start vetmedin. Vinny entered stage B2. We started vetmedin. And that actually created a reduction in heart size, which is partly how it works. It reduced the heart size. It brings the valve closer together. You get a 30% reduction in the regurgitation volume on average with vetmedin. Vinny did great for several years, probably 3 years. And then Vinny started to get progressive left heart enlargement, progressive enlargement of the left atrium, the left ventricle. And we were worried that Vinny was headed towards congestive heart failure. So we added actually enalapril at that time. We added enalapril. Enalapril is very safe. I think it tends to be very effective in some patients, not as effective in others. In Vinny, we actually got a slight reduction in heart size after adding enalapril, and we were able to go about another 12 months without symptoms. And then Vinny started to develop symptoms. And it started out with just a slight increase in cough, but over about 3 weeks, it became much more severe. And we got Vinny in, we did a chest X-ray, and we found fluid developing in the lung, pulmonary edema. And immediately we decided, okay, we're going to start furosemide or Lasix. So we added Lasix to the treatment regimen, which was already enalapril and vetmedin, and the symptom went away right away. One thing that they hadn't done reliably, but we usually recommend to people, is that they start counting the sleeping breathing rate. If you're on vetmedin, especially on vetmedin and enalapril, which we would kind of classify those as like a D2 plus patient, we want them counting the sleeping breathing rate at least once a week, if not more often, because the sleeping breathing rate is usually about 20 breaths per minute. And at above 30 breaths per minute, statistically, that patient is going into congestive heart failure. And so that can be more reliable than cough. There's so many reasons dogs cough, but the sleeping breathing rate doesn't go up for very many reasons. And so anyway, after that, they became much more diligent about counting the sleeping breathing rate. And I tell them it's going to keep you out of the emergency room. If you will keep an eye on that, then my commitment to you is that we're not going to have emergency room visits if you can do that. And often it will do that, because they'll see it coming back. When the congestive heart failure starts to come back, they'll see it coming back. But that's kind of when we entered stage C.
Okay, so sleeping breathing rates. I know that some dogs at this stage also can experience a syncope. I know I experienced it with my own dog, Chelsea. She had some syncope episodes from it. So, in addition to that, are there other ones that you would monitor or other feedback you would provide for monitoring progression through CHF phase towards end-stage disease? And what criteria guided the transition from, say, aggressive management to palliative-focused care?
Okay. Well, you're right. Syncope, it happens in about 30% of patients. So you drew the short straw there with your dog. But in some ways, I like syncope because it's dramatic. People can't mistake it. And other than for seizure, possibly. But for me, knowing that they have severe valve disease, if they have a syncopal episode, I usually would say, okay, we need to do something different. Things aren't stable. Your blood pressure is not stable. And syncope is where they often will either start to develop pulmonary hypertension, and that is a common cause of syncope, or they'll just have just a low cardiac output. When they get excited, they don't have enough cardiac output to sustain the blood pressure to the brain, and they'll pass out, and it'll sometimes look like a mini seizure. They can get stiff and urinate, and people will call it a seizure, but that's a classic syncopal kind of history. But it usually means we need to make a change, and often that's increasing the diuretic, adding spironolactone. We will often do that, and we're typically monitoring kidney values right after their first episode of congestive heart failure. I usually see them back in 3 months. If they have a really good visit then I'll say, okay, let's see you in 6 months. And after that, we're seeing them usually at least every 6 months until they start to have one of two complications. Either they're having frequent recurrence of the congestive heart failure, or they start to develop kidney failure. And that's when I start to have a tough conversation with them. Usually we're, 18 months into stage C, but sometimes much longer, and occasionally less. But right around 18 months, we're starting to have a lot of those conversations where, hey, we're struggling with this congestive heart failure symptoms. And if that's the case, but the kidney values are still okay, we'll escalate the furosemide dose. We'll sometimes add another diuretic like hydrochlorothiazide, or we'll switch them from furosemide to torsemide, which is a more potent loop diuretic, to try and control those symptoms. If the kidney values are bad, we can't do those things. And so will sometimes try to reduce blood pressure a little bit more by adding amlodipine, which relieves the mitral valve a little bit of its regurgitant problem and doesn't harm the kidney as long as we don't lower the blood pressure too much. But usually by the time we're doing those things, we're starting to say, hey, it looks like time is limited. So keep that in mind. And usually over the next 6 months, the family's deciding that either the symptoms are too severe for congestive heart failure or the kidney failure is becoming symptomatic and they're not eating well, they're losing weight, and maybe their quality of life isn't as good as it was.
Yeah, I talk a lot about this in GP world about quality of life and longevity, quality of life with CHF patients. Sometimes if they're seeing me more frequently than we want them to be seen, coming in more on emergencies and making sure that they're sleeping through the night. Like if the day-to-day routine has changed quite a bit from their good quality of life to like, oh, they're really struggling here. It really is a time to really, help them cross over with the dignity they rightfully deserve,
Right. And that, and I usually, people will ask me like, will you tell me when it's time? And so I'll help you with it, but you'll see it. I mean, you'll notice it and you'll feel it. And some people you have to help them more than others, but I, sometimes I worry that they'll feel like, well, this is a specialist. He's expecting me to go to extreme measures for my dog. And that's not true. I mean, I'm just trying to help them and help their dog and help their relationship and make sure that they're having, both of them having a good time with this relationship. And if they're, if they get to the point where, things really, they feel like the dog's miserable, they're miserable, I'm going to support them with that decision. So that I always want them to know, hey, don't look at it like you got to do a pacemaker and a dog whose heart's failing or something like that. That's not really what I'm interested in and what I'm trained to do.
You bring up another good point. It's so true, and I look back on it. Out of the cases that we deal with end of life care, I do feel that with cardiac and CHF specifically, pet owners do know. They do know that it's generally that it's time, and they look back and they will always say no regrets. They said no regrets. We did everything that we could to give them the quality of life that they rightfully deserved. And I do value and respect this disease and the decision when it comes to that because of the fact that, because the advancement of the science and the medicine that we're talking about today, that they're getting incredible quality of life with their animals. And so that's what we're hearing now. Like, wow, she had a great 2 years, like 2 years. When I started practicing, it was like maybe 2 weeks,
I know. I
So they're
know.
living longer. And so
It's
with that
amazing.
comes a lot of less regret, less guilt, less understanding, more understanding and more respect for the human animal bond when it comes to those decisions. So I think that's great. And when we look back, when you're looking back on this case, such as Vinny, for example, what are some of the biggest lessons for clinicians and pet owners about prevention, early intervention, and making compassionate end of life decisions in mitral valve disease?
Well, clearly the biggest impact that we have is stage B2, I think. I actually love mitral valve disease because I think this is the disease in veterinary medicine we're best at treating. I mean, there are extreme things that you can do. Maybe extreme is the wrong word, but there are some advanced treatments you can do. The University of Florida, for instance, is doing an open heart mitral valve repair program. So you can have your dog's mitral valve repaired for about $30,000. There's also a clamp that you can do on the mitral valve that's kind of a hybrid interventional procedure. And there's several private practice centers that are doing it and a few universities. The people that have the most experience right now are at Colorado State University, and they're going in and clamping the mitral valve, creating like a double orifice mitral valve. So they clamp the valve where it's leaking the most severely, and they're having some pretty good outcomes. There is some risk with that procedure, and I know some of my friends have attempted it and have had some complications, but that is something out there that's about half the cost of open heart repair that you could also do. But B2 valve disease is like every veterinarian in the country should be treating B2 valve disease because you can actually treat it with just x-rays. There are certain criteria that you can hit with an x-ray, heart enlargement wise, that should tell you it's time for vet medicine, even in an asymptomatic dog. If they have a vertebral heart size of greater than 11.5 and a vertebral left atrial size probably greater than 2.8, although we know for sure greater than 3, either of those criteria, you should start vet medicine. So there's several indicators for vet medicine, echo and x-ray, and that's where we have the biggest impact. So that's what I would say the take home should be. The lesson learned for Vinny is start early, and it's so much better to start it when the heart size isn't already huge. I don't think the drug works quite as well when it's massive heart. It works better when it's moderately enlarged.
Yeah, I like that you shared that. I just came back from VMX too, and they were talking about that being more proactive on getting them started on vet medicine earlier in the stages, like just like you were talking about versus later on, because it's got a lot more efficacy, I guess.
Yes.
So
Yeah. It's almost
great.
like you miss that
Yes.
15-month window if you wait till they're symptomatic.
Right. Fantastic information. Dr. Church, thanks for joining us here on the Vet Blast podcast. All the great work that you're doing.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I love helping people with heart disease, and I really want veterinarians to be empowered to make a difference in their patients' lives, and hopefully if there's some clients that listen to this, that they'll be motivated to go see their veterinarians.
Yeah, we do have some clients that tune into this, so absolutely. And I like that you shared that. Of course, again, we work in a preventive medicine, proactive pet care arena, and cardiology is one of those as well. We want to make sure we recognize the heart murmurs, and there's so much now that we can do to have them living longer, healthier lives. So thank you so much, Dr. Church.
My pleasure.
Thank you to our friends at Boehringer Ingelheim as well for supporting this wonderful conversation. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone.
Important safety information. Vetmedin, pimobendan chewable tablets, and Vetmedin solution, pimobendan oral solution, are for use only in dogs with stage B2 preclinical myxomatous mitral valve disease or congestive heart failure due to clinical myxomatous mitral valve disease or dilated cardiomyopathy. The most common non-cardiac adverse reactions reported in field studies were poor appetite, lethargy, diarrhea, dyspnea, vomiting, musculoskeletal pain, and ataxia. For full prescribing information, see package insert or visit vetmedinpi.com. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.